Arm Aronson of the Total Sports Recall Podcast here to share a winning strategy for Father's Day from our partners at Sterling Roastery. If your dad treats his morning coffee like a pregame ritual, you need to introduce him to the Sterling Roastery lineup. This isn't that stale, over-roasted stuff sitting on our grocery shelf. Sterling roasts their beans multiple times a week for unbeatable freshness. The smart play? A coffee subscription. He gets to choose his grind, from French press to espresso, and his favorite roast, depth. It's a world-class lineup of Java that shows up like a reliable veteran on a perennial powerhouse team. Go to sterlingsoap.com and set him up. He'll thank you with every cup. That's sterlingsoap.com.
Tonight, we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the rugged fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats. Welcome to Gridiron Greats, football, history, and its memorabilia, on the Sports History Network, and in conjunction with Swick Enterprises. And we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150-plus years of football history and memorabilia, and you can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats magazine, a football memorabilia historian, specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Larger. He hails from Portland, Oregon, Mr. Joe Squires. Joe's momentarily delayed and will be coming on shortly. In the interim, I'm just going to touch base very briefly upon the revival of Philip Rivers as the new old quarterback of the Indianapolis Colts, who braved the elements in Seattle this past Sunday and turned in a reasonably good performance with regards to what he was able to do. And I wish him all the best as he goes on the next few games with the Colts. If he can bring them to the playoffs, it will remain to be seen what happens with that. All right. So we're looking at the Rivers situation in. Okay, I'm getting a message from Joe. I'm gonna continue to. Okay, we'll move on from here. He'll be on in about 5 minutes. Our special guest tonight grew up in the Dallas area and at an early age fell in love with the Cowboys. One of the first memories of his is watching Super Bowl V. His Cowboys fell to the Baltimore Colts, ironically, the same team the Dallas Texans became. With his first book, he wanted to chronicle something that had never been covered before, and this goal was fulfilled in his history of the NFL's last failed franchise. Today, along with his wife, Deb, he still resides in Dallas and remains a football fan and avid historian. Also, as of May 2025, he's also a recently retired restaurant executive from his day job. I'd like to welcome to our show, Mr. Mike Kober. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, Bob. Thanks. Thanks for having me here. Thanks for bringing up Philip Rivers before me, because it makes us all not feel so old after all.
Well, at 44, I give the guy a lot of credit, because it's not a good situation to be hit by some 350-pound defensive tackles coming right at you on a rush type of thing. But he did a pretty good job the way he played the game, and what he could do. You know, some of his passes were very rusty, and some of his passes were pretty good.
He had 3 days' work. I mean, I was pulling for him. I tell you, I think he's played a lot better than some of the other veterans I've
Oh
seen.
yeah. So anyways, he did a good job. I'm pleased with what I saw, so on and so forth. And I think a lot of people are happy, and a lot of older people are very happy to see somebody that age who got back on the field and played and did a good job. You know, the one thing I found interesting too, you think about older people in the NFL. George Blanda is the first person that comes to mind. I mean, he's a guy that played into his 50s, and you know, he did an incredible job. I mean, he was an Iron Man. Look at Brady. Brady's a little different, but George Blanda is a great example of somebody who did play well into quote unquote past a career type age. So it's very.
Yeah, 40's the new 30, I guess, isn't it? I remember some of these guys that I was growing up with. I thought they were old, and they retired at 34, 35.
Yeah, which is old today in the NFL. I mean, you know, again, a lot of guys are—they're lucky they make it to 30, and that's it. You know, and
Unless
they're.
you play quarterback, I saw Aaron Rodgers last night. Looked like the old Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's start off, and if Mike, if you could tell our audience how you became interested in football and the 1952 Dallas Texans.
Well, the first time I ever saw mention of this team was in this book.
Okay.
There was a whole series of them that came out in the early 70s, Great Teams, Great Years. And it's a little history of the Dallas Cowboys. There's just a one little photo and one little mention, and I had known about the AFL Dallas Texans, and I read the caption. I thought, well, that's not them. This is a weird looking picture, but I just kind of put it away and grew up. And lo and behold, later in the early 90s, when the Cowboys started their ascension to becoming, relevant again, and Jimmy Johnson was building the team, I would watch the ESPN specials and shows all the time because that's really all we had before the NFL Network. And NFL Films, they used to have these shows that would come on called NFL Presents or whatever, and they would
Right.
have different clips of Red Grange and George Halas or NFL stories. And they had one time about the Dallas Texans, and it kind of triggered, and I thought, wow, I remember seeing something about these guys. And the fact that they weren't a semi-pro team, they were an NFL team, I thought, wow, that's kind of interesting. The film's still out there. You can look it up on YouTube. It's kind of rough now, grainy, but that's where I became aware of them. And then over the years, the internet came up and started finding out a little bit more about them. And I just kind of had an interest there because you got the Cowboys down here, you got all this other NFL history. I grew up always checking out books in libraries. And when you're about our age, I mean, the books that you check out are books that are written about guys pre-1960 or teams pre-1960, and that it kind of triggered my interest. So, wanted to learn a little bit more about it, and went around the internet, didn't find much, and
Right, right.
That's kind of what made me think, well, if I could get as much as I can and collect all this together, be kind of
I
cool.
agree. I mean, for a 1 year team, and it is one of the, you know, the last failed franchise of the
It
NFL.
was the last, yeah. I mean, there was like 48 before them,
Yeah.
and they were
And
the
again.
last, and there was a gap between the Brooklyn Dodgers and them
Right.
in 52, and there never has been another one, and I don't think there will be again. I mean, there probably could have been some misses. There's some definitely some owners that were forced out of the league. There's some teams that didn't do so well, but the NFL, I don't think that
Not
the
today.
fellowship will ever let a team go,
Today,
forfeit
especially,
again.
I think they're at such a level where that it's such a quote unquote prestigious franchise. It's a wealthy franchise. It's a franchise by far and wide that is coveted by many owners. and or syndicates of ownership, so on and so forth. I agree with you. I don't think you'll ever see another failed franchise as in our lifetimes, to say the least. All right, let's move into your. I see your book in the background there, Words of the League. Let's talk a little bit about that. And in that case, in that area, tell us about your book.
Well, I wanted to write the story, the entire story of the franchise, not just about they played 12 games back then. They won one of them, and I mean, how interesting can that be? But wanted to write about the before, the after, how they were born in Boston as the Yanks. Ted Collins was an entertainment manager to a woman that made God Bless America famous. He got the Boston Yanks franchise. He wanted a franchise in New York City where he was from and lived. Couldn't get the NFL to agree to that because that was giant territory, played in Boston for a few years, didn't make it there. Finally coerced them into letting him move to New York. Didn't go so well there. They had one winning season in that whole time between 44 and 52. And not wise to try to start an NFL team up during the war because of lack of manpower, lack of available heads. Wound up selling or turning he sold the team sold the franchise marker back to the NFL, and Commissioner Burt Bell was looking for a taker. And Dallas was just down in Texas. It was a hotbed for football with the Southwest Conference, and how could it not make it? And now you look at what's happened with a guy from Arkansas in 1989, put down $155 million, and now he's worth, and the franchise is worth, what, $12 billion? I know we had to revise that number three times while I was finishing up editing the book. And I don't know how soon you're going to put this out, but it may go up to $13 billion before it comes out. But anyways, as I said before, we came online. It's an untold story, and I wanted to collect as many little snippets of what this team was, and kind of document it, and how the family that was the main drivers, the Miller brothers, how they got their money, how it all happened, what the problems were, and the downfalls. Like I said, then later on, there's a chapter on Baltimore. I mean, there's a lot of debate whether or not this team became the Baltimore Colts. To me, the sum of its parts were collected up by Burt Bell and sold to Carol Rosenblum, his summer neighbor, and formed the Baltimore Colts with the same colors and same equipment, same players, same everything. So, I think that to a large extent, the NFL and the Baltimore Colts, they don't want to identify with this legacy because it was so bad. You wouldn't want that on their resume.
The NFL, in my opinion, has in a lot of cases forgotten about its history after, or I'm sorry, before the merge between the AFL and the NFL. And especially in the 1950s, there is a lot of history there that is not remembered in any way, shape, or form. This team being one major aspect of that history where they're not really publicizing it, they're really not discussing it, but discussing it, so on and so forth. One point I want to bring up while we're talking about your book, tell our audience how many actual home games were played in Dallas.
Okay, good. That's a good pop question. Okay, they played, they had six exhibition games back then. They didn't call them preseason because they scheduled them themselves. They played one in Dallas toward the end of the preseason. That was Detroit. They opened up and played the New York Giants here. The next week, they played the San Francisco 49ers here. They played the Packers here. And then the last one was the LA Rams in a monsoon. So they played four regular season games and one exhibition game. And I don't want I mean, I want to sell books here, but I don't want to give it away. But one of the dumbest, maybe naive, not dumb, one of the most naive moves that they made was there was only one place to play down here, and that was the Cotton Bowl, and it was a fine stadium back then.
Right.
And part of their lease meant that they couldn't share the concession monies while the State Fair of Texas was going on. And it's a huge deal down here, as everybody probably knows. Then out of their, first 3, 4 weeks, a couple of home games, they didn't get any concession money. So they had to forego that just due to an oversight. All
Right.
kinds of bad moves. But yeah, they played 4 regular season home games here, and I think the total attendance of people that came out was maybe, I totaled it up once, it's like 55,000 total between all of the games. First game was 17,500 folks, and most of them didn't stay. It just got worse every game.
Yeah. So that kind of did them in from the start. And again, it is interesting to think in the historical perspective of what would happen. Texas is a big football state. However, at that time, Texas was more of a high school college hotbed of football rather than anything to do with the to the
And the Cotton
profession.
Bowl was us. The Cotton Bowl was, I would argue that it was maybe one of the best stadiums in the NFL at that time for that 1 year, held 75,000 folks. And it looks really bad when you only have 15,000 people out there.
Right.
So, that's really what happened. The very last game against the Rams, as I said, it was in a terrible monsoon rain. It had rained in Dallas for days. And the Cotton Bowl has these overhangs, so everybody got up under the overhangs. So it looked completely empty the last game, if you see any footage.
Yeah. Joe is here.
Yeah.
Well, my co-host.
I
Hey,
apologize,
Joe.
but I don't make a mistake of the time very often. I had a dental surgery this morning that just finished, so or else I would have said bump in an hour.
All right, Joe.
So my face is still a little numb.
We're working. We're going into the second area here where Mike is talking about the book itself, and he's given us a little background on it, and it's pretty interesting to see what actually happened. At this point, I'm just going to show real quick. I have a 1952 Bowman Small Barney Poole Dallas Texans football card. Back of the card, if you can see it, has a number 36 written on it. So back in 1988, I checked my files. I started buying, made a group lot buy at a show of Bowman football cards. And unbelievably, or believably, I paid $1 each for the cards I bought. This is one of the cards I paid $1 back in 1988 for. Okay. And I didn't really care at that time whether there was writing on the back of them or anything like that. So to me, it's whoever wrote the 36 on it, with some of the cards I bought, they wrote 36 on every card. So I don't know what the symbolism of it was or whatever. But it's just a kid probably writing number 36 back in 1952 when he got those cards, type of thing. So
Looks in good shape. Good thing he didn't put it in his bicycle spokes.
I didn't put any of my cards in.
Mike, I apologize. I'm late, Mike. Yeah.
Yeah, dental work. I mean, you have my sympathy. I've had more. I think I have more crowns than I have regular teeth now.
Boy, not good. Now you talked when we as we were talking before and we were communicating before via email. You said you had struck up a friendship with the son of the team's owner. And can you expand on that and tell us how it helped you with the book itself?
Yeah, Connell Miller Jr. Connell Sr. was the older brother, and Giles Miller was the younger brother. They were the two primary drivers and owners of majority owners with the syndicate that had the team. Giles was the guy that kind of did it all, but they always did everything 50-50. But Connell had the eldest child, Connell Jr. And back about, I don't know, several years ago, we have a magazine down here, Texas Monthly, and he had written an article about his father's team, and it was published. And I thought, well, these pretty cool looking pictures. I had been trying to collect more info on the Texans. So I contacted the folks at Texas Monthly, and they just put me right in touch with him. Just did a little email introduction, and I found him from the get-go. He was just very genuine and welcoming, and we just hit it off. And I wanted to find out more about the team, and we started talking, and it kind of became our Tuesdays with Maury kind of set up.
Good riddance.
And anyways, he was, he wasn't that old at the time, but he was really one of the only ones in the family that remembers anything about it. And I remember the day that I was telling him, or asking him, would you mind? We've been talking a lot about this. Would you mind if I maybe wrote a book about this? 'Cause, I'm a restaurant guy. I was no professional writer. He actually knew what I was going to ask before I did. And he is such a joy to talk to. I remember one time after we started talking initially, he was moving, and we were kind of talking as he was unpacking. I could hear a lot of commotion in the background. And he said, "Micah, hang on, I think somebody's in here." I said, "I can hear voices coming." And he goes, "Yeah, somebody's in the house." And he was supposed to be alone, and he starts walking through, and I said, "Maybe you should just hang up and call the police, or I'll call them for you." And anyways, he found out it was Alexa in the other room talking to him. But Connell was, he was such a great source. I mean, he had a lot of his mother was she took a lot of pride as one of the owner's wives, and she sat on the board, took a lot of pride in the team. Connell had introduced me to his cousin Ed, who is Giles Jr. He's Giles's oldest son. And Ed was, he's totally different than Giles, but they both became really good friends. And Ed was the one that really put me on to the number one source that I used in writing this book. And that was Giles Miller in 1972. He was running a newspaper in Park City's area in Dallas. I mean, he lost most of his money and stuff, but he had a little publishing company, and he wanted to write a little book about his life with the team, and it's got a very long title to it, this book. There aren't many in existence. He said in the book there were only, he was going to print 50 of them, and he's just going to give them to his family members. And he signed off and personalized each one of them. So if you have one, and I've only been able to account for about less than 20 of them, but it's a little paperback book. So it's really, it's kind of the first book that was ever written on the team, but it really wasn't because nobody even knows about it. You don't even find them in auction. But Ed, he had one. He knew he had one somewhere. And it was one of those things where he's like, "I got it in boxes and da da da," and he kept looking and looking. God help him! And in the heat of the summer, and attics and sheds and barns, and he thought it was either lost or damaged or whatever, lost in time. Walking through one day in his house on a hall shelf or something, there it is in plain view, sitting out on a shelf. So he loaned me that book, and it was going to be, well, you use it. He's so great.
Reference.
Mike, you use it as long as you want to use it. And I thought, yeah, give me 3 weeks, 3 to 6 weeks, and I wound up keeping it for 20 months. And it was just it was a valuable, critical, crucial source of information, because the way I looked at it, if Giles had written about something and it was in that book, it was straight from the horse's mouth. And but like Ed had said, it was kind of a self-confessional to his family. I mean, it was really, it wasn't a thing I could pinpoint, well, this was the failure, but man, he had a lot of details in there about things like how Lamar Hunt had later asked him for permission to use the Texans name. And, I mean, he had it down to certain financial records and what he paid players and friendships and stuff. I mean, he didn't have the best, I don't know that anybody could have the best relationship with Burt Bell back then, because he was so gruff, and he was a football lifer, and he just kind of was hard to deal with young people like 34 and 36 years old like these brothers
Yeah.
were. So, but I mean, he talked a lot about how he kept the friendship going and his relationships with some of the other owners, and
Mike, by the way, you're doing a great job having your book framed over your left shoulder there.
I thought, well, you know what, if you haven't seen it, I sent you a photo of it, and I know we'll talk about that at the end, but
Yeah, I would love that.
those that haven't seen it, yeah, that's kind of a cool picture. It came off of a like a movie reel. One of the local stations here had had it in their archives about the Texans at training camp. So,
Getting back to that book, so apparently, if he wrote it in 72, that was the 20th year anniversary of the team. So that has some from there. I mean, to me, that is such a phenomenal historical artifact of NFL football history. And it's the first time I've ever heard of it. It's truly amazing.
Bob, I just have this feeling somewhere out there in a flea market in Nebraska or wherever, there's a box of paperback books and it's sitting there mixed with a bunch of the other ones. It was it's like a little library style book. It's not very large and the font is incredibly small. I mean, I had to get some new readers just to be able to see it. But it had good information in there. It had some photos that had never been shown before. A couple of them I put in my book. It's too bad that there just weren't that many of them out there. I mean, like you, I collect things. I mean, I would buy one if I could find it on eBay or something, but I've never found one, and I don't think that anybody's going to, unless the family decides they want to republish it for some reason. But it's not. Giles was a great. He's a neat guy. He's a nice man. He's cool to research. But he wasn't a writer. I think in his own family will tell you that. I mean, some of it's kind of tough to read.
But again, still from a historical point of view, that's just incredible. That blows my mind just to hear something like that.
It's good just to get the story out. I mean, so be it. If it's not, the way you're used to reading things or perfectly, but it's.
I mean, my book's probably not that great in spots either, but you know what? It's you get the story out, like you say, and nowhere else are you going to find out about, a meeting that he had with one of his players, or he walked into a bar after a tough game in San Francisco, and he sees the guy sitting at the bar, and they start drinking till 3 in the morning. Little things like that particular guy, even his own family, didn't know. Know the story because I know this because I worked with one of his relatives. But
That's great. I mean, the little nuances of it are great. I mean, who's the guest we had a couple months ago? Not the other president of the NFL when it started, Joe Carr's, counterpart, and he had story after story, receipts of things being bought. It was fascinating, and every little detail was just added up to the history of the NFL. It was all perfect. I mean, just every.
Well, yeah, there's, I mean, a lot of that, Joe, in the book. I mean, Giles talks about equipment, for the team, which I guess is, helmets, pants, everything. It's like the number that he had on the ledger, it's like, holy crap, that's what like a monthly mortgage is now. You bought all of the stuff for that, but, Yeah, it's fun. It's fun to even though the book's been out for a year, to still be able to talk about it, and it's still new to some people. And one of the biggest kicks is I've done a few book signings, and particularly young women, they'll come up and say, "Well, I bought this for my dad for Christmas," and it's always cool that that they've said, "Well, I get to share something with him that he didn't know about." Because everybody down here is a Cowboy fan. I mean, the Rangers can be in a pennant race, but the Cowboys go to OTAs or mini camp, and I mean, that's the biggest thing going.
How do you, I mean, a team that's defunct or moved, I mean, how do you, it must be really tough to, I mean, you had a reference book. I mean, how much of it came from the previous book and how much of it is information you had to gather? How hard is it to
Most of its information I had to gather. I had written probably a goodly portion of it, maybe not half of it, but 40% of it, before Ed found Giles's private memoir. And you know, a lot of people, they have books that, and I've read some of them. I just hate it when you get a book from somebody and they're basically just taking snippets out of everybody else's book and writing quotes about it. And it's like, that's not writing. That's not the way that I wrote this one. So most of it were just stories that I would find in obscure places, you know, old magazines, Saturday Evening Post, and there was a magazine, Ebony, that had some articles in it, and you know, just Collier's, Sports Digest. You know, there's just little things that you see this old magazine, and you had no idea that there was a piece of Texans information in there that would be so critical to writing your book and connecting
Well,
things together.
and the NFL and NFL teams aren't really, good at maintaining their history,
Well,
especially.
and you know, not to knock the NFL because I mean we love it, right? But I mean, my contacts with the NFL when I was trying to get the permission or the grant, copyright grant, to use the little Texans logo that I think I'd sent you a copy of, big barrel-chested Texans, because you'll never see that on the internet now. They didn't know that they had it. You know, they didn't really have, they didn't keep the copyright up or anything. So can't really give you permission to use something that they don't own. So it was like that. And I think that, you know, the generation that works now, in this business, most of them don't know about the team, or you know, they've moved on and they're all Cowboys and Chiefs and what's new now, you know?
And you have that. You sent that to us. I can share that.
Yeah, they
Pretty good.
yeah. And
Wow.
Not very well known. I mean, I've seen it before, but I mean, it wasn't in use very often or for very long, so.
No, if you Google Dallas 1952 Dallas Texans, the little picture that comes up is the Kansas City Chief Dallas Texan logo,
Totally.
the red and gold. But yeah, I thought it was cool. I mean, I originally got it from Connell from our initial meeting, and Giles had probably had drawn it up himself because he was a doodler. So that was where it was thought to come from. And Connell was like, I don't know if where that came from. I don't know if that was ever really used or not. Well, you
We
know,
had
Bob and I were
oh,
talking before you came
it's
on, you know, collecting the game programs. If you open it up right there, the first picture you see is that picture of that Texans logo. So I'm like, oh, nope, that's it.
and Mike, that was small. That's a 100 or that's a 13 kb size fonts. I mean, that's somebody scanned that out of something. Yeah, that's not, oops, sorry,
Yeah.
hit the wrong button. Yeah, that's not very big. So that's somebody scanning it out of something and having it.
Well, it's actually that picture or something like it. It's that's the cover of Giles's book. And I don't know, I think I sent you a copy of his book too, where it looked kind of like that, but it looks like, you know, somebody's been coloring on it and it doesn't look as sharp as what that image is. But he put that image on his own book as well.
Joe, you have the program covers. Can you bring those up?
I do, yes, sir. Yeah, I will go
We had
over.
mentioned them previously, and I remembered now, and you reinforced that there were only four actual home games for
Yeah, that's the preseason game against the Lions. They
okay.
had 30,000 folks at that one, or they said to have had that many in as the turnstiles, but they gave a lot of the tickets away, and who knows if there were really that many folks or not.
They
Exactly.
printed 30,000.
Yeah. Second game was the Giants game. That was the high point of the season for a while because they went to a 6-point lead off of a fumble that a guy named Tom Landry fumbled and gave him the ball, and they scored right away. They missed the extra
Right, Mike.
point. They're up 6-0. Everybody that was there was excited, and
I
then they
like
got
this one.
outscored 24-0
Somebody
down the
wrote the
stretch.
score there. Dallas Texans 14, Green Bay Packers, Bob's
Yeah.
maybe 24.
We're all into condition and stuff, Joe, but to me that's really cool. I mean, that's somebody that was there and
Just
they
having
probably
it.
curled it up, put it in their coat pocket. People used to dress up back then, and write the score on there.
I
That's
love it.
really neat.
Yep, here's a good one. LA
Yeah,
Rams.
that's
It's
the
the last
last
game.
game.
November 9th, 1952.
That was 27-6. That wasn't bad. I mean, most of their games had a score that made it look closer than it really was. And that one was probably closer than the others because I think the Rams had come in here and they were just totally unmotivated to play a
Yeah,
team that
this
was this
artwork.
lousy. And they actually played the Rams the week before. That was one of those rare times where they played in Los Angeles at the Coliseum, and then 7 days later, then they play here in
So
Dallas.
this artwork is incredible. Just coming out of the clouds almost. And that helmet, look at the reflection spot on the helmet there. It's
A lot of
incredible.
Art Deco to their programs, you see.
That's definitely 1950 classic football styling.
Or
No,
yep. Here you
jersey.
go.
Beautiful,
Here's
beautiful,
the
beautiful.
Giants, 24-6. So far, I haven't seen a win. What was their record that season in 1952?
1-11.
That's pretty good. Like Bob mentioned, some good fall colors in there.
Well, talking fall, I mean their lone victory in the fall colors was Thanksgiving Day. They beat the Bears at a neutral site game. It was supposed to be a home game in the Rubber Bowl in Akron, and that's a whole chapter in of itself. I call the Thanksgiving Miracle. There's the 49ers game. That's the second game of the season.
Yeah, I like this. Look at the detail of the cleat, the reflections on the heel, the sock sagging. I mean, that's just.
And classic for 50s and 60s programs, you would write the score of the program of the game on the front of the program. And a lot of collectors, especially today, shun that because they want a perfect program. I always argued you have a historical program that was probably really at the game with somebody following, the game itself, and in some cases would actually do the scoring inside the program.
Yeah, they all have a centerfold scorecard with the lineups and everything, and the quarters, and you can make notes and stuff in there. And some of mine have little doodling like that, and some don't. But
I mean, I was just gonna say, like in a baseball game, it's traditional where you get a scored program type of thing. And in this case, they wrote the score. They would write the score on the front of the program. I have a lot of programs like that. I
Mike,
enjoy them.
you want
I'll
something
admit
that's
that.
been loved, and the fact that somebody really just didn't just kind of take it and keep it, and they want to keep it in mint condition. Back then, it's a one. There's probably a lot of them that just got thrown away. Game's over, throw it away, and it's only
Mike,
50 cents.
this is probably one of the favorite pictures you sent us last night or a couple days ago. Just this is almost a professional photo with a good backdrop and the lighting and et cetera. Just really cool.
Yeah, that's my helmet. I'm looking at it right now across the room. That's what they wore. It's the same Baltimore PMS, whatever they call the color blue. Has that crazy looking white stripe across the front, and it tapers down in the back to practically nothing. And then they had the blue jerseys with the little Texans arm patch on there. So. Even on black and white photos, before people started putting, back then, the only team that had any kind of insignia or anything on their helmets were the Rams with the horns. And I think a few years later that the Colts came in with the Colt with the horseshoes behind the helmet. You see a black and white picture, which is all you're really going to find of the Texans. You'll know if that's them just by the crazy looking helmet.
There's that taper you're talking about. Really nice looking. Paint some of those up. All right. You had some other photos you sent.
Mike, while we're looking at those, did you actually collect stuff from the Texans? Any cards, memorabilia, those programs, or whatever?
Yeah, I have all the programs with the exception, and I've got the visiting programs as well.
Okay.
With the exception of the home game that they, at the end of the year when they forfeited, before, in early November, they were going to finish out the games on the road, much like the Saints had to that one year, right? And so they played the Lions in a home game in Detroit.
Yeah.
That one I have not never found a home a program for. I don't know that they made it. And then the one in Thanksgiving in Akron at the Rubber Bowl on Thanksgiving Day. That not even a scorecard. I haven't seen one of those. Other memorabilia. This little guy here I think is kind of cool. A little Texas, And then the back of him, he's got the helmet thing too, in the script. I've got that and some other things. I haven't. What I wanted to get the, and you kind of said something about this earlier. I wanted to get the programs because those were actually at the game, and there weren't
No,
any
I agree.
souvenir things where you could order it afterwards. There's some programs that I've been able to find more frequently than others just because of the attendance, number one, and maybe they just printed up a bunch of them that didn't get sold and didn't get tossed.
Right.
Typically back then, after a game's over, people back those days, they didn't think about keeping things around. They were just like, well, throw them away. And just like a lot of the old ticket stubs, they probably got thrown away if they weren't sold.
Yeah. What was you sent over some team photos, and this one obviously of Art Donovan, Hall of Famer, caught my eye.
Those one of the cool things is that I found the team photographer is still in business, Squire Haskins. They specialize now in more aerial photos and stuff, and they were very helpful. The president, Karen Campbell, she's been in my home. She was one of the first books that I gave because of the, she was so gracious and let me use these team photos of the players. Those were all taken at training camp. I think I sent you Buddy Young and a couple of others. You had the Barney Poole card there a while ago. Bob, I've got Barney Poole's picture too. All of those slide negatives were destroyed in 1970. They donated a lot of the catalog to some university
Buddy
archives.
Young.
If these are just kind of like one, not one of a kind, because there's probably more than one out there, but when you find one, you want to grab it. And then they have little stamps on the back of it with the name of the player and then the photographer's stamp, like they used to do with the phone number and stuff. But yeah, those were cool to collect too. They weren't like bought at a game or anything, but they were kind of distributed through the team and probably given away at signings and stuff. I know that one of the sources that I had was a podcast that was done by the grandson of the one of the owners, and they're quoting Gino Marchetti, or Marchetti is quoting himself because he did the interview about how he went to a signing, an event over here in a men's clothing store in Fort Worth, and he probably had his picture there and walk in there, and they were, well, we're here to do some, greet some people, and they didn't even know who he was. This is one of the greatest football players that ever played, right? But
Unbelievable.
Connell Miller's story that was in Texas Monthly I talked about earlier, it really says it better than any of us could. It was titled Right Place, Wrong Time. I mean, I kind of start the book out like that. Now we're talking about a city that boasts having the most valuable sports franchise in the world
Yeah,
today,
no kidding.
and these poor guys couldn't make it through a season.
Well, this was a pretty good one. I mean, I don't know how rare this is, but.
That is a story in of itself, because at the end of the book, I'm talking about how, Joe, how they just didn't get any respect. I mean, history didn't treat them kindly.
One in
And I had
11
said
different
something to the
tournaments, yeah.
effect that, they don't even have a team picture to show for. And through the deadline had come. I was needing to we let's go to print on it and everything. And then shortly after we published, one of the sons of one of the players who had been in touch with me a lot and shared a lot of things, he said he found another box, and he found a particular box that had a cartoon drawing of his dad that he'd been looking for. And he was just taking pictures on his phone, and that was in a newspaper, in the Kerrville newspaper, that was just right prior to their first exhibition game. And I thought, oh my God, that's the same field and that's the same players. I mean, I've been able to identify all but about four of them on there. In fact, scroll up a little bit, right there in the middle. Do you see number 34? Right in the
Yeah, right
middle.
here.
Okay, go up one. The guy that shows his head right there, that's Fritz Von Erich, the wrestler. And apologies for the graininess, but that came out of a newspaper, and I had that restored by a fellow that works with the Cowboys as best I could. But that's cool because I never thought that there was a team photo of any of them. There was never one published. Yeah, that's the same fields that you see in the other photos that you just showed.
I
I
like
that.
I can only imagine if you found an original print of that team photo. I mean, that is so beyond rare. And the other thing, finding an actual jersey from the 52 season, there's got to be.
They were probably, and back then they were probably, it's thought that that the blue ones were sold, just to get some travel money toward the end of the year. And they did this, even the Cowboys did this when I was a kid. After the season's over, they'd take those game jerseys and they just practice in them until the holes took them over. They'd just be completely worn out.
That's
So
the day where they wear three and four jerseys so they can market them
we
immediately after the game.
Yeah, and then they trade them the players after the game. They're so tight now, I don't know how they get them off.
No kidding. How does it, like, at what point were you like, I'm going to put a book together about this? I mean, where does it go from being a collector? This is a really fascinating topic and something I live here, so I'm
Sure.
going to dive into. I'm going to write a book about this. I mean, how does, yeah, how
I
do you
think it
decide?
happened that I saw that Connell had written that article, and I saw so few things out there. And like you guys, when I read a book, I keep them. I mean, I don't get rid of any of my football books that I read. And I've read so many, and that there've been the fact there've been so hundreds of books written on the Dallas Cowboys. I don't even know how many there have been. I've never ventured to count, but not one book was written about this team. And I thought this would be a cool topic because you'll be the guy that wrote the book about the Dallas Texans. So that's why I wanted to find out as much as I could about it. And when you do that, you're like, well, if you've already got all this stuff, why don't you just kind of make notes, put it in writing, and somehow or another, it wasn't hard to kind of concoct it into a book. Once you get all the stories, and even with the book coming out, and even if there were some notoriety, there still aren't a lot of things out on the internet. So it was kind of a labor of love, to be honest. I would tell anyone that wants to write a book, make sure it's something you want to write about, and that's for me, it was a labor of love, labor of curiosity. But it happened real fast because I thought, every time you find something else out, you think, oh, here's another thing, here's another thing. And before you know it, I think I can put a book together.
You hit send to go to your publisher, and a week later you find a team photo, and you're like,
I know,
damn
stop the
it.
presses. But one of the things, there's a photo in there too of the team in their parkas that say Dallas Texans on the back, and they have a star right in the middle of it, long before the Cowboys used the
That's
starter.
pretty cool.
And the Baltimore Colts actually repurposed those and put Colts patches and stuff over them whenever they moved, because those were probably pricier to manufacture than some of the other things. But anyways, that photo that I used, I really wanted to use that one on the cover, because it came off of an NFL Films feature, the one that we were talking about earlier. But it just kind of was what they call it, pixelated. It was just too grainy. I mean, it came out into a nice little 3x5 image that you'll see in one of the chapters, but it wasn't good enough to use as a cover. But
Don't tell all the stories. You got to make
yeah, I want to leave them
leave the
enough that
people
they'll want to
wanting
buy the
more.
book.
Yeah. All
Mike, where can our audience buy your book?
Well, the usual sources. I mean, Barnes and Noble, if you live in Texas, they're in the stores. You can get them off their website, Target, Walmart, and then of course Amazon.
Okay.
And Amazon and Barnes and Noble, you can get it in ebook if that's your thing.
Okay.
A lot of people like that because they can blow it up and read it. But
All right.
yeah, that's where it is. And getting out into the stores and meeting people, that's been kind of a trip, because you write a book and you think, it would be really cool to walk into a Barnes and Noble and get a little coffee and go walking around shopping for books like I do and see your own book on the shelf. And
Yeah.
I got to see that, and then I got to see displays, and then I got to see people buying them. And it was kind of a trip, something that you never thought you'd get to see. So
It's a great feeling. It's a great accomplishment. I mean, you really
it's
do.
one I can't describe. I mean, and then somebody comes up and they want to know, "Hey, Bob, you want to sign your book?" It's like, "You really want me to sign this book?" But it's a good feeling.
Now, it's because, you're a historian of the game. You preserve the history of the Dallas Texans from that.
Love what you do. You'll never work a day in your life. I just like I wanted to learn more about it, and write about something you're passionate about,
Exactly.
and know this. I mean, when you get down to things, your name is going to be on that book and to infinity. So make sure everything's true and accurate. Nothing's
Yeah.
fabricated.
Yeah.
Make sure there's no spelling errors. I saw a book recently, a football book, that the guy's got the same picture on the same page. It's like, what happened here?
I get it.
There's a fellow that was my editor that actually he works in publications for the Cowboys, and he was so cool because he knew all about the story. And I remember he told me, "Mike, this is your book, and when you put your name on the cover, then if there's something wrong in there, then they're not going to say, well, the publisher got it wrong."
Yeah, exactly. Well, Mike, we're out of
Absolutely.
time. I appreciate you taking time out of your schedule to talk about it, and it looks like a great book. And again,
Buy
thanks
it
for
at all those sources. Don't get it on eBay because it's Christmas time and I need the money.
Okay, we heard it there. Joe, we're almost out of time. I'm going to hand off to you. What'd you pick up
Thanks,
on?
guys.
Mike, thank you again for being on the show.
Thank
Really
you.
looks good. Thank you very much for sending over some good photos. I always enjoy seeing, photos and stuff that people have, collected along the
Let
trip.
me know if you need anything else, and happy holidays, guys.
Thank
Okay.
you.
Same to you. And yeah, that was an incredible story. I knew something about the Texans. I really didn't know a lot about them. And that really was very informative, to say the least. And again, to write a book about it, to me, is truly a major accomplishment for him, and to preserve the history of it. And again, we beat up a dead horse all the time. The
Yeah.
NFL doesn't like its history for whatever reason.
Yeah. I always tip my hat to people who grab, the bull by the horns there and just grab an esoteric topic in the NFL and dive deep. I mean, that's history that needs to be revealed and hit,
It's just so sad. I mean, it's just becoming very tiring for me as I get older to really continue this questioning why you're 100-plus-year-old league. You have so much history. throughout the years. And I don't know what history they are supposedly ashamed of that they don't want to, advertise it. They don't want to discuss it. Doesn't make sense to me. Really doesn't. Never has. Well, anyways, we're out of time. If you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine,
What are you waiting for?
gridirongreatsmagazine.com. Check it out, get online and subscribe. Our latest issue is being worked on as we speak. It'll be out over the next week or so. And hopefully, we got a couple more podcasts before the end of the year. And until that time, we'll see you then. Take care.
Hi everyone, there's a new podcast in town, Statman and Robin. We are the dynamic duo of Baltimore sports history.
We have lots of stories to tell about the great and not so great teams and players in Baltimore's rich sports history, and some of the more obscure ones too.
We grew up together with these teams and players, and we'll add our experiences to these great stories.
Yep, we were there for a lot of them. Join us here on the Sports History Network.